approved. Can you please read item number 442? It is a report.
Accept the City of Portland, Portland Police Bureau, and Multnomah County District Attorney's report on illegal drug impact areas.
So I'm pleased to, it says 45 minutes. It's going to be much shorter than that, right?
Yes.
Okay. This council is crabby. It's budget season. And no, trust me, council is crabby.
Well, then it may be helpful to
I'm
start.
Crabby, so we're all crabby. But this is good news, and it's a bright spot in the day. It's a very positive note. So who do Ms. Sandy?
To that end, it might be helpful to start with some compliments to council for your hard work this week. I know it's been a busy week, and we'll try to keep this report shorter in the interest of time, and so that everyone may testify. Thanks to Commissioner Leonard, Fritz, Saltzman, and Fish for their statements in support of this program last April, and to Mayor Sam Adams for his creative approach to public safety problems and creative solutions. So as a little bit of history and context, this was a resolution passed last April to create illegal drug impact areas. It allocated $2,500,000 of funding to
$250,000.
Thank you, Mayor. To assist Multnomah County DA's office in prosecuting drug crimes and reestablish walking beat officers. The reason we did this is because there were concerns from Old Town Chinatown businesses, residents, and particularly noteworthy is the letter our office received from the residents of the Sally McCracken building who were feeling like drug sellers were interfering with their road to recovery from substance abuse. 28 people signed that letter, and we felt compelled to respond. The community was asking us to respond by reinstituting drug-free zones. However, our office had no interest in doing so because of the Campbell report and because of concerns about fairness. So what we did instead is we created illegal drug impact areas, which, unlike drug-free zones, are not based on arrest. Illegal drug impact areas are based on conviction for drug crimes. They link people to treatment through the service coordination team, and Austin Raglione will present more on that. And our goal really is to reduce the market for drug sales by decreasing the demand for drug sales and addressing the problem of sales in Old Town Chinatown and everywhere in Portland. This is a problem based on Portland Police Bureau data. And Billy Prince has more information on that.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Appreciate you guys having us here today. My name is Billy Prince, and I'm at the District Attorney's Office, and I have been the DA assigned since the beginning of the project, and I appreciate what is an absolutely unique approach in terms of tougher sanctions on one side and encouraged treatment on the other side. Some data about the success of the Drug Impact Area Project. Since it began, we've issued 400 cases inside the drug impact areas. As you guys know, we created three different distinct areas for heroin, cocaine, and marijuana, and those 400 cases represent about 25% of all the drug cases issued for those three drugs in countywide. So we're seeing, you know, a lot of cases issued coming out of a pretty small area. In terms of how many of those were drug dealing charges, 121 out of the 400 charges were for drug dealing. So about 25% of the cases that we issue coming out of that area are for a drug dealing charge, the other 75% being for possession. Interestingly, of the 121 people that we charge with drug dealing crimes, 95 of those folks had an address outside of one of the drug impact areas. So we're seeing people come down from somewhere outside of the downtown, Old Town, Chinatown area to sell drugs, which is obviously concerning. People who don't live in a community have less respect and less care for what goes on there. A big component of the drug impact area was bringing back these exclusions. We did use PPB data, and that's why we have the three distinct areas. You'll notice that in some places, Lloyd Center is included. Some places, it's not. The cocaine zone goes a little farther north than the heroin zone, and that's because that's what we were seeing with the data. We wanted to make it as narrow as possible. Obviously, when we're asking a judge to tell somebody they can't come into an area, we got to have a good reason. Our reason is the data that we have, as well as the desire to have the 25% of people that are charged with drug dealing crimes not go back to sell it, 75% of people that are dealing with addiction to stay out of the areas where they can easily get it. Of those cases, we've had 417 exclusions that have been issued in a nine-month period, and those include both crimes inside and outside the drug impact area. We haven't had a single judge deny us a request for exclusion, so anytime we've asked for it, they have given it to us. We also haven't had a judge find that somebody who is in violation for being back in the zone was there properly. Built into the exclusion that they get in court says, hey, you're excluded from this area unless you're doing one of several things, housing, treatment, service providers. You're going to see your PO. You're going to see your attorney. That's built right into the form as opposed to the drug-free zones where they had to get a particular variance from a judge. So that's been extremely effective. Like I said, the 100 we're finding about 25% of the drug charges that we issue have to do with dealing, and that holds true with the exclusions. 112 people that were convicted of drug dealing charges have been excluded from the drug impact areas. We wanted to figure out whether or not we were excluding the right type of people. At the six-month mark, I took a sample of 90 folks that had been excluded for convictions that arose out of one of the drug impact areas, meaning they were picked up down here and convicted of a crime. Out of those 90 people, they had 447 felony convictions and 434 misdemeanor convictions. So we're talking about a very small group of almost 900 criminal convictions. Also important is out of that group of people, about a third of them had a violent felony conviction in their past. So we are excluding the right types of people in the sense that these are people with extensive criminal histories, with a third of them with violent criminal histories. Ms. Raglione is going to be speaking about how we work with the service coordination team. I think it's important to point out that they have a halftime DA from our office, and the focus of that DA is really to get these people, chronic offenders, through treatment and all the things that involved there. My focus is shutting down these open-air drug markets, two different focuses. In terms of my involvement in the neighborhood, one thing that I really try to do is get out there to the different neighborhood organizations, whether it be a business, Old Town, Chinatown, downtown Portland, and attend these meetings and really talk to people how it's affecting them. Throughout just about every meeting, the feedback has been extremely positive, with people sending letters in and support. And so obviously those are the people that are most impacted by it, and the feedback has been positive. I work closely with PPB, like I said, to attack these drug dealers. It is extremely helpful for the police officers to be able to come to a DA and say, hey, we got somebody who's being a real problem. What can we do? And that is the advantage of having a single deputy focus on a particular geographic area, is that the relationships that I build with my officers allow us to be much more efficient, allow us to take chances on cases that are sometimes difficult to make. If they have a warrant that they need signed, they know who to talk to. If they have a project, they don't have to shop around and try to figure out who to go to. I'm the person. In addition to working with PPB, we've got some park rangers that are going to be taking over a certain amount of sort of quasi-security in the drug impact areas. I've done a training with those guys to kind of inform them, hey, this is what the project is. This is how you would be working with PPB. And I think that that's also critical. We have a lot of non-police people out there that are coming into people that are excluded on a day-to-day basis. And it's important that they are aware of the project. You're going to hear from Mr. Weiner today. I had Mr. Weiner come in on a trial that I had, and I think it was a case that was extremely indicative of what the drug impact area has been able to do for the community. It was a case where walking beat officers interrupted a hand-to-hand drug deal in Old Town. They spoke with the buyer who had a $10 bill in her hand and was about to hand it to the dealer. They interrupted that drug deal. When the dealer was walking away, he tossed his crack on the ground, right? No care for the school children that may be walking by. You know, he just wanted to drop that on the ground. It's a tough case. It's not a lot of crack. He didn't have a lot of cash on him. It's one that, you know, potentially would not be picked up, not be focused on. But the defendant in that case was extremely bad guy. Violent personal convictions, previous drug dealing. He had a drug dealing charge from 1988, two blocks away. The guy's been in it forever. Now, the purchaser, the police officer, spoke with her and didn't charge her with a crime and said, hey, listen, come in and speak at grand jury. Turns out she was really struggling with addiction. She did come into grand jury. She came into trial to testify. When I went out to get her in the courtroom, she was waiting. I could tell she's nervous. It's nerve-wracking to testify against a guy like this. And she looked at me and said, hey, listen, the reason I'm here today is to make sure that people like me don't have to deal with people like him. That's what the project is trying to do, get people treatment and people who don't want it to make sure that they can't impact. So I appreciate it. I think that there is a lot to do with this project. I think it's been successful. It's taken a long time to develop these open-air drug markets. It's going to take some time to shut them down. So.
Can I ask you a question? I support this program, and I really appreciate your participation in it. Some of the numbers seem to suggest that we're also having a lot of convictions outside of the impact areas, and we've heard concerns that we may just be putting the deals in other neighborhoods. Could you address that, please?
You know, one of the things that they is often a concern is displacement. And, you know, the studies that I've seen, displacement doesn't always occur in the way that people would think. The open-air drug markets are established in a particular area because people know where to get the drugs. So I don't think that displacement is as big of a problem as people often think. The other thing is, with the relationship with PPB and the relationship of the data, if we are seeing displacement, if all of a sudden the Whole Foods and the Pearl becomes, you know, a open-air drug market, then we can shift our boundaries. We can shift where the drug impact area, as long as there's a relationship between what we're seeing on the ground and where we're excluding people from.
And I think maybe our colleagues in blue might speak to it as well. I've been waiting with keen eye to hear from folks up in, you know, Northwest Portland, where we normally hear displacement. And I have not heard that yet. We have had some displacement further south into the downtown, but we also then know that that is displacement. So we recognize it, and we're able to get on top of that, and the police bureau might talk about that as well. But the fact that this is the whole ecosystem of potential sanctions, but a way to, you know, leave this terrible life and have a better life, and it's, in my opinion, post-conviction. So there's just a lot more stick-to-itiveness about it, I think shows. I could be wrong, it's just I'm not hearing the kind of displacement complaints I heard with the old drug-free zone.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So we have 400 total criminal cases within the areas and 1,202 outside. So those 1,202 are not in any particular area. They're dispersed throughout the Portland City County.
Yeah, so those would represent anything that's not one of the drug impact areas. So anything on the east side, that's that 1,200 cases issued. So those are cases that have been issued, not necessarily convictions yet.
And if we did have a new hotspot somewhere on the east side, for example, would we, what's the process for establishing that as a drug?
Well, I can tell you because we've had some interest in people from the Hayden Island group, and what they did to for me was they got in touch with PPB, and they presented us with data, crime data, and I will take a look at that. And because we have a threshold with a quarter of the cases issued coming from a small area, you know, we have some base point, and we would take a look at that and decide whether or not it's feasible to be able to create a new DIA. It's funny, you know, when I go to these community meetings and they say, I want to be in the drug impact area. Can you just move it on to my area? And like, I don't, you know, there's negative connotations as well, but the idea and the response is that if the data is there, we have no problem moving that around.
So would that come back to council, a new?
I think that in terms of once the way that the particular ordinance is worded, it is focused on parts of the city where there is a much higher concentration of drug crime. And so I think that it's already in place with the ordinance that the DA's office, who is in charge of drawing those boundaries, could then draw new boundaries.
The city had just, I don't know if you were here as part of that, the city attorney was very clear with us in order for this to all stand up, that the DA needs to be the first and final decider. We do updates on general criminal information and calls for service. We hear from the community. We present that information on a regular basis to the DA, and we don't decide politically. The DA decides based on the facts.
And then you would just let us know that that's what's happened.
I don't know that we've done a good job of that yet, but have we changed the boundaries?
Nope, boundaries are the same. Yeah.
So we've done a great job of that.
In
the future, we will.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just fantastic work, absolutely fantastic work. Particularly like the passion that you bring to this, and the passion that's very evident in your not only your presentation here, but your team's work on the whole intended sort of ecosystem of this effort. That it includes law enforcement, includes prostitution, but it also includes treatment.
Okay. My name is Austin Raglione, and I'm the program manager for the service coordination team from run by the Portland Police Bureau. I will echo your comments, Mayor Adams, about the work of Mr. Prince. It has been stellar. The excellent work and the passion and commitment that he has brought to the table and understanding of what we're dealing with has been really impressive. So thank you. I just want to let the council know when you approved the DIA program, you made it very clear that you wanted us to marry both the law enforcement end of it as well as the treatment end of it. And so what we have done is we have screened every single person who has received an exclusion. And I presented some materials for you there. I won't go into a lot of detail, but I will let you know that of the 381 exclusions that were referred to the service coordination team, 152 of those met the eligibility requirements. And just briefly, because this is a crime reduction strategy, we are looking at reducing the criminal activity of people addicted to drugs. So the screen is about three drug arrests, property arrests, police contacts, or detox holds within a quarter of a year. So those people that meet that screen are then presented with a letter inviting them to participate in our services. And 152 of those people receive that letter. 58 have actually taken us up on it. We have served or are currently serving 58 people who have received exclusions. Later this month, on May 15th at 9 a.m. here in Council Chambers, we will be graduating about 14 people from the service coordination team, and five of those were referrals from the DIA program. So it's definitely doing what we intended it to do.
Austin, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
On the handout of statistics, it lists housing and treatment allocations, and it seems anomalous that you would list Golden West as wet housing in connection with this program. So could you just clarify that?
Yeah, the service coordination team does have 24 units of wet housing at the Golden West. And what
can
that...
You explain what wet housing
yes,
is?
Yes, so what that means is that people who are just coming... most of our clients are homeless, so they're coming right off the streets. And we bring them into the Golden West, and we help stabilize them and get them on a treatment track. So during that period of time, they are not exited from the program for using. They're not allowed to use or drink on site, and we move them into treatment track within the first week. But what I'm saying is that for dry housing, for instance, at the Estate Hotel, that's a zero tolerance. You cannot use. And we UA our clients on a regular basis.
And the other question, and you might have already answered this, and I apologize if it's already in the record, but where you list the total enrolled for 2008 to 11 at 613, less duplicate enrollments, does that mean people who've gone through the program more than once?
Absolutely. The majority of our clients have been enrolled at least one time before they come in and get it the second or third time around.
Mm-hmm. I just would like you to restate the results, in terms of recidivism. And this is a client population that suffers from some real life challenges. So these are really hard people to help and to help themselves.
Absolutely. Our clients are considered some of the hardest clients to deal with. We're often considered the last house on the block. Most of our clients have been in treatment numerous times. Most have served many years incarcerated. Most have spent decades homeless. So they're a difficult client population to work with. But our program is specifically designed to work with this population in terms of providing the treatment services, the criminality services, as well as the mental health services that we provide. So we did the Portland Police Bureau ran some statistics on arrest records for our clients. So we counted up clients that had been in the program over a course of about 3 years, the middle of 08 to the middle of 2011, and we ran for 265 clients who had been in the program for 2 weeks or longer. And the result of that was that overall, the reduction in recidivism was 52%. For the graduates of the program, the reduction in recidivism was 91%. And for overall, for non-graduates, people who had been in the program but didn't complete the program, their reduction was 43%. So really impressive statistics, I think, given the fact that the population they're working with.
Sir, welcome.
Good morning, Council. My name is Brian Hubbard. I've been a police officer for the City of Portland for 16 years. 15 of that I've spent in Central Precinct, and 90% of that has been working street-level narcotics in some form or another. I was the Old Town Neighborhood Liaison Officer for a number of years back when we had that program, and I've spent the majority of my career working Old Town. And I've seen the ebb and flow of the drug problem as it comes and goes over the years. But one thing remains consistent throughout that time is if we don't have a program or we don't put focused effort into it, the problem grows. I believe that effective community policing needs effective tools. I was a big skeptic of this program when it started, the service coordination team. I've been at it since its inception, and I have to honestly say, and I can say with a straight face, that this program works. I've seen some people that were chronic repeat offenders that I thought they're lifers, and I thought for sure one of these days I'd find them dead. I've seen these people come out with a smile on their face with a new hope for life that I never thought possible, and I shook their hand and looked them in the eye, and just it's very refreshing to see a tool that actually works. During the walking beat that I've been a part of both times in this last year, we've made well over 1,000 contacts. On a personal level, it's not in the car. We're out talking to these folks at all times of the day and night. I work the detail a lot at night, from 10 at night till maybe 4 in the morning. There's a lot of people out. And during these contacts, we encourage these chronic users to seek treatment. And we're there as a mentor. It's more of a mentorship. We're not there to beat them while they're down. And our presence also keeps the I call them predatory dealers, and in check, because that is exactly what they do. They come down and they prey on the people that are suffering from addiction, that are wrapped up in the Achilles heel of humanity, that don't seem to have a way out. And by having officers that are dedicated to this program, that are not working in a district, that are not taken away to go take a radio call, which is needed. Walking beat officers are not subject to radio calls, so we can take the time to be focused on these chronic offenders on a consistent basis, weekly. Again, I'll reiterate that the service coordination team works, and that we have to be consistent in keeping up the pressure. I believe that if this program goes away, not only will it be bad for the neighborhood, it'll be bad for these people that are really struggling with addiction. And I would not like to see that happen. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. Thank you for your service.
Thanks to all my colleagues up here. Our office, we recognized that the solution wouldn't be exclusively a law enforcement solution, that we really needed the support of community members and businesses and other resources to combat this problem. So we've been working with residents, with business owners, with service providers, Multnomah County and TriMet and the Police Bureau to create a better downtown. We're avoiding concentrating homeless services into a single geographic area. We're creating a safe and vibrant downtown by staying on top of changing circumstances and continuing investments. We have equipped business owners and community leaders with the information and tools they need to run well-managed operations and help ensure the public's safety. And we also participated in a City of Portland public budget survey for fiscal year 2011 through 12 by DHM Research. That group conducted a telephone survey of Portland residents to assess their feelings about the community and the city's budget priorities to assist us with budget development. The outcome of that survey was that majorities supported the use of cameras in high crime areas to discourage criminal activity. Top priorities for the police service were crime prevention, gang activity, and drug activity. And almost 7 in 10, 69%, either strongly, 41% somewhat, and 26% supported the use of cameras as a way to discourage criminal activity and aid in identifying those involved in crime. 28% opposed. Chief Reese is here, and he will be telling you more about that. But before he does, we have some community members here that were key in helping us think of a solution to this, Howard Weiner, Gary Cobb, and Jamie Dunn.
Can I just ask one question? Is it Officer Hubbard?
Yes, sir.
Officer Hubbard and Mr. Prinz. You started out by saying heroin, cocaine, and marijuana. It's like every day you read about prescription drug abuse being, the most important, not the most important, but most prevalent type of abuse going on. So I'm just wondering, is that something you see also, prescription drug, methadone, or is it just harder to make a case in those types of buys and sells? Or are you not seeing it?
I can speak on that. The prescription drug issue, there's a bit of a problem downtown. It's not as prevalent as heroin. Typically what we see, and it's almost it could be a boilerplate story when you talk to a heroin addict. Almost 100% of the time, it's someone that got an injury, got addicted to the painkillers, and looked for a cheaper alternative, which was heroin. Same thing with high school students. They, use it recreationally and then end up hooked on heroin because it's a cheaper, readily available alternative.
That's a very useful explanation. Thank you. Thank you all very much. And before you step away, Emery, thank you for all your great work on this. I really appreciate it, and the results are self-evident. So thank you.
And thank you for yours.
So folks that would like to testify? And we'll time.
I had one sign-up sheet.
How many people are signed up?
Nine.
Okay. So we'll give everyone 2 minutes. If you can say it in something less, then you're a citizen of the day.
Time for lunch. My name's Howard Weiner. I own Calskate Skateboards down in Old Town, and I chair the Public Safety and Livability Committee. I want to thank the council, and particularly, Sam, I want to thank you. We came forward as a community last January and February when conditions in Old Town Chinatown again rose above the norm, if you will, of drug dealing. We'd had stabbings, we'd had shootings, and it was just getting worse. You came forward with a number of recommendations when we met that created this ordinance that we have now. It significantly reduced the drug dealing in Old Town Chinatown, and particularly the violence that comes along with it. We still have issues that we see from on a daily basis, but what my concern is the sustainability and how we can sustain this effort. I've been down in Old Town since 1984. I've seen things get better, things get worse, but how do we do it throughout your administration and the administrations that will follow? So that's really all that I need to say. Everyone else has spoken to this. You've got great folks on the ground doing this work, and I really appreciate the efforts for all of us in the community. And one quick note on the cameras, which I didn't know anything about. I support having the cameras in Old Town Chinatown. We've had them. As I understand it, this is really a technicality in indemnifying the owners of buildings that if a camera drops off the roof, they're not going to be sued. And I think it's one more tool that we can use. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And just a programming note, that's the next item on the City Council. It is totally related. The original IDIA strategy included them. And as you mentioned, this is indemnifying private property owners for the placement of cameras that look onto the public right away. It's been reported that this is a police bureau initiative solely, and this is not a solely a police bureau initiative. It comes out of this strategy. Doesn't mean council, you know, the council will consider it and make their choices. I am absolutely supportive of this effort, and where we have cameras, we solve crimes. Where we have cameras, we're more likely to solve crimes, I should say. And where we have cameras, we're more likely to prevent crime. However, cameras can be abused, so it's good to have this at City Council for the public debate and make sure we're striking that balance. Sir.
Thanks. Yeah, if I could, one question for Howard.
Sure.
Howard, we had a report a few months ago on the initial data on Bud Clark Commons. The number of people who have come through the day center, shelter, and the people being housed. And the numbers in terms of day center were off the chart, thousands of people coming through. Have you seen any change on the ground around your business as a result of having the day center operating down the street?
Yes. And to bring it to point, Sisters of the Road, which I support in all their good efforts, before the Bud Clark Center, it was like a safe haven, that corner. It was also problematic for others trying to get across the street and so on. But there were groupings of maybe 175, 50 folks. You don't see that today. And if you talk to the folks at Bud Clark Commons, a lot of the folks that were out on the streets are now in the Bud Clark Commons and having the opportunity for services. And I thank you and really the City Council. It's just another tool in ending homelessness, and they've done a great job. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sir.
My name's Jamie Dunn. I own Gill Club on Broadway and Everett. I'm also a board member with the Pearl District Business Association, and I volunteer with the Portland Development Commission's Urban Renewal Advisory Committee for the River District. I can't really say anything different than anybody's already said here today, and I completely agree with Howard. In the 7 years that I've been in my location, I've seen the neighborhood essentially go through some changes outside of the issue of the drugs. When I originally opened in 2005, the sky was the limit, and development was abound, and everything just looked rosy. And then in 2007, when things slowed down a little bit, we just sort of hunkered down and waited. And I'm reminded now, after the IDIA has been put into place, of those days back in prior to 2007, when things really looked positive and it looked like the neighborhood was had nowhere to go but up, and was on that path and growing. And that is because of the work that everybody's done and put in with the IDIA. Prior to that, last year, the neighborhood certainly didn't look like it was going up. It looked like it was heading in the other direction. And so I thank you for your efforts and everybody's efforts, because it really does feel, again, like we're back at a place where we as the community and the business owners and the residents can start to take back our neighborhood. And I think that in the long term, to really make changes in Old Town Chinatown and in that neighborhood, the police really are not very effective. They can only do so much. I think that the idea is that they need to be there in order for the residents and the businesses in order to care and grow the community. And I think that we're at a place right now, particularly with the laws that are in place, to do that and to really kind of take ownership and responsibility for our neighborhood. And that is the ultimate goal. So that's enough for me. So thank you, guys. I really appreciate it. And I'm looking forward to seeing another year worth of this effort.
Thank you. And thanks for both of you for all your work on this. And someone else who has been a key partner, welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning, Mayor Adams and Council. My name is Gary Cobb. I'm the Community Outreach Coordinator at Central City Concern. I testified last year when we started, when we took testimony, or the resolution was being presented, and Central City Concern supported it then, and we support it now. And my office is right down at Ground Zero, right there at 6th and Everett. And in the past year, I'd have to say that there has been great improvements with some of the law enforcement activity, some of the business activity, and everybody that spoke today coming together. And it kind of brings back that whole community policing idea that has gotten away from us. And I think we're going back in that direction. It's really, really important that we keep on with this direction. I would like to say that there are some residents that brought this to our attention. And I think that petition that we introduced last year was given back to you. And Mick Opplinger came up here with me today, and he was the community leader that helped generate that. And I think he gets a lot of kudos for this and helping bring this to our attention at our agency, because sometimes it's easy when you're in the mix to kind of see, miss how bad it really can be with all the dealing going on. But like I said, the last year has been very, been a lot of improvements, and I've happened to meet a couple of the folks that will be graduating from the service coordination team. I think Austin and those folks are just doing wonderful work. And the irony of the folks that are on that petition, they lived that life. There were some of the people that would be down on the streets that a resolution would have to be created to get them to stop that activity. So they know exactly what is going on, and they do feel that they have been preyed upon because they'd run into some of their old dealers. And so you can imagine how uncomfortable that must be. So I would like to thank everybody on behalf of Central City Concern. I'd like to thank the City Council, all the partners that testified today, and we're in a position to want to be of help in getting folks out of that life. And I want to remind all of us that since the disease of addiction does not discriminate in who it grabs, we cannot be discriminatory in our practices on helping folks get out of that lifestyle. So,
Mayor, since Gary's here, can I just make one observation? We've been getting some calls from people about the Mark Hatfield building.
Oh, okay.
And they're the kind of calls we wish we got every day.
Right.
And my colleagues have no doubt seen that at the corner of Broadway and Burnside, the scaffolding has come down, and the Mark Hatfield building, which Central City Concern operates, has been restored. Right. And it's a jewel of a building. It's a beautiful addition.
Great.
And my colleagues supported an investment of about $900,000 of TIF into that project. It's now energy efficient. The units have been upgraded, and it's actually, frankly, been revealed as a beautiful building. So I just wanted to thank our friends at Central City Concern for all the great work they've
done. I'll pass it on. Thank you, and thanks for the partnership. And, you know, we have a lot of work to do to get folks to help and, you know, getting buildings for them to live in. So
I'd just like thank Mr. Weiner for persevering as a business owner, a longtime business owner in Old Town.
Yes.
And Mr. Dunn, congratulations on 7 years. I think we all know how tough it is to survive in the restaurant business. So, and especially in a what in many respects looks like a good location on Broadway, but as we all know up here, it's also a very tough location. So, congratulations. Thanks for your involvement.
Thank you. Thank you all. All right. Are you testifying? No. You signed up. Okay. Let's go to the sign-up sheet.
I had one sign-up sheet. Did you want to do the other ordinance yet?
Why don't we read that?
The title.
Title.
Okay.
Oh, you had one sign-up sheet for both? Okay. Yeah, we'll have a presentation on the cameras and then go from there.
443, authorize the chief of police or designee to execute access and indemnification agreements with property owners for installation of surveillance equipment on their property.
Chief Mike Reese. Welcome back.
And commissioners.
And thank you and your team for hard work on a very long day yesterday. And I was getting texts at 10:30 at night with updates and early in the morning. So make sure that you pass along to the team. Thank you for the extra work.
I will. It was very challenging, and I believe our officers did an exceptional job in protecting people's rights, but also protecting property and businesses and the rights of everybody in our community yesterday. It was a very difficult day in a number of ways, and we saw in other cities in the Northwest it didn't turn out as well as it did here. I really, as I was listening to the presentation from our folks, have to comment that this is an innovative approach, and it is one of the most unique programs in law enforcement that I've been involved in. And it is a collaboration that doesn't often occur in law enforcement, where you have our police officers working hand-in-hand with treatment providers at VOA, the Volunteers of America. You've got Central City Concern that's providing housing. You've got parole and probation, district attorneys, business owners, and drug users all coming together to really change the environment. And we're seeing some very, very positive benefits. And I think the service coordination team model is something that we want to replicate in a number of areas, whether it's mental health issues in our community or addiction or homelessness. We can, through unique collaborations and unique partnerships, really change the environment that allows crime or disorder to occur. In regards to the cameras, I appreciate the opportunity to come before you. This is an issue that has come up recently in the public domain, and I think it's one that is valuable to have a conversation with council about. Cameras have been used by law enforcement and other government agencies for a long time, and we've had cameras in use in Old Town in the past as part of our drug efforts to target these hot spots, and we realized that we were maybe leaving business owners hanging out a little bit with the liability issue, and so that's why we came to council to address that concern that the city attorney had. But in our community, we have cameras everywhere. I think sometimes we don't realize how much technology has progressed over the last couple decades, but I think we're all familiar with the images that are captured on TriMet platforms and buses and MAX trains. We've seen the ODOT cameras that give us updates on traffic, but we also use those for law enforcement purposes as well, as we may go to accident scenes or at times when we've seen ODOT cameras that are picking up crime on freeway systems or bridges. We have cameras outside City Hall. They're here watching the sidewalks. Certainly the Justice Center has cameras that are focused outside on public spaces as well.
Also one at the traffic light right out here. Thank you.
For keeping him in check. That's another, we'll talk about that in another
We appreciate your contributions on a regular basis.
You're welcome.
So the cameras are not unique to our public domain, and I think it's a valuable conversation for us to have around public policy. This technology that we're using allows police officers to more effectively monitor hotspots. So in certainly in Old Town Chinatown, there are corners that are known for drug dealing, that's the spot to hook up, and that officers can use cameras to monitor that location, and when there's a deal that goes down, they can then interdict that deal in a much more effective manner than if they're just simply walking by or driving by and the dealer or the user sees the officer approaching and they part company and we never have a chance to make an effective arrest. It allows us to hold people accountable. That when you take a video to court and show a jury and a judge what occurred, and there's no dispute about it, I think it really shortens the time in trial, and it makes folks more accountable for their actions that are having a negative impact on our community livability. Cost of the technology is fairly minimal. It's dropped over the years, and I think in no small way a lot of homeowners have purchased technology of this that they can watch on their laptop. You can watch your home camera from work and see what's going on outside your home, and it is a technology that an area that is booming in our community. The storage of data has been an issue. Certainly with our camera systems, the data is constantly overwritten after a day or two, so that we're not storing massive amounts of data. We only store when an investigator needs the information for a case. Then that data is pulled and it's stored according to our city policies and state law. And then the last thing on this, it allows officers, the gang problem, I think, is another area where we could be very effective in the use of this technology. We have certain hotspots. Those hotspots have grown throughout our community. So now we have a very lean police department, lean gang enforcement team responding to gang issues in Inner Northeast and North at 162nd and Burnside and other areas. You could save a lot of time if you could have access to a TriMet platform camera at 162nd and Burnside. The officer wouldn't have to drive from North or Northeast Portland out to 162nd to see if there was gang members hanging out there. They can pull up those images on a camera and save time. Same thing with places like Holiday Park. I think that's another area where we've had significant issues over the past. We've done really good work there, but again, it's another way for us to use technology to be more effective in our response. So I thank you for your time.
Keith, I just have a question. You and I had a conversation the other day about an incident that occurred in Delta Park where someone broke into a van and stole property belonging to some college kids that were playing in a tournament, and whether we should think about putting some cameras there. And I'm just curious. I mean, you're right. Cameras have become ubiquitous, and probably from the minute I leave this building to pick up my car, I could be photographed a dozen different times, stop to get money at the ATM, cross a street, and on and on. But my question is, do cameras act as a deterrent, or are they a tool to help apprehend people engaging in unlawful conduct? And where's the balance? For example, I mean, is it prudent to have signs that say you're on camera, as to enhance the deterrent side, or does that not really influence behavior, so it's more in terms of developing evidence to be used against people engaged in wrongdoing?
Again, it depends on the type of investigation that we're conducting. Sometimes we use a covert camera system to capture images, possibly of a known drug location, for example. Other times, I think there's great benefit in having a camera system that people know they're on camera, and I think certainly on TriMet platforms you've seen that work, and that it has a impact on people's behavior when they know that there may be somebody monitoring it on their criminal behavior.
So just like when you're at someone's home and there's a sign saying, I have a system in my home that's operative, there are some instances where you'd want to have a sign announcing that to people that they may be on camera in order to deter them from engaging in certain conduct?
Yeah, certainly a lot of businesses do that now. They'll make a public notification that there's a camera. Anyone that is paying attention can look around and see cameras literally on almost every building in downtown. They're everywhere.
And if I could sort of summarize what you said with my words, which probably make it less clear than more clear, but the best way for us to prevent the next crime, or a key part of preventing the next crime in a particular category, is solving the old crime.
Yes.
And so whether it's the cameras that most recently, the pictures of which were in the public realm of a convenience store, that's an example of having pictures, being able to get out a description and showing the picture of the individual who had a weapon pointed at the cashier. That has been helpful in us getting the community to tell us if that individual was in their neighborhood.
Absolutely.
Another example of how it works both ways is that one of those platform cameras caught a police citizen interaction, and that was used as part of the investigation in terms of discipline for the police officer. So that is it can go both ways when the view of the camera is capturing police and citizen interactions.
Yes.
Do you have a written policy on things like how long you keep the tapes and where they can be used and what they can be used for?
The city attorney has a policy, and again, it depends on the type of investigation that we're doing. But Dave Warbrill would, I think, be the appropriate person to talk about the different policies around record retention. Depends on the type of case it is. The information that we're currently collecting is overwritten unless an investigator pulls that and keeps it on file for a criminal case.
But you had mentioned that it's just kept for a day or two before it's taped over. Is that written down in policy somewhere?
It depends on the system itself. So, for example, we're proposing to we have a pilot project where we're going to have cameras inside police cars, and we're going to be capturing information about traffic stops and things like that. That policy will be different than the policy. The record retention on that will be substantially longer than what we would propose in this, simply because the technology is different. And we are storing that information longer, not because we have to, but because we want to. It's expensive. One of the main expenses in this type of technology is storing the data. So unless you're required to, we want to constantly overwrite it so it doesn't cost more money.
Thank you. So for this particular use of viewing the right-of-way, what's the policy for how long?
It generally, as is Warbill here?
No, but it's like 24 hours. I mean, the systems are built to just record over after 24 hours.
All right. And thank you. And so I'm used to the security cameras at OHSU and psychiatry, where pretty much all of the areas have cameras for the safety of the patients. And we have had they still do have. I used to be part of being assigned to look to watch the cameras. Will somebody be assigned to watch the cameras in this program?
No, officers. Our hope is that officers like Brian Hubbard would have on their MDCs or on their smartphone an IP address that when they're working, when Brian's out working that walking beat and he wants to see what's going on a certain corner, he can pull it up on his smartphone or on his MDC and take a look. And then if he sees drug deals going down, then he can focus in on that.
There wouldn't be a bank of monitors at Central Precinct where somebody could watch?
No.
Okay.
And I think one of the other issues in terms of signage is, in addition to whether signage is useful to the investigation, but requiring signage sometimes is absolutely what a particular part of town needs. Sometimes, though, I know there is some Twitter talk about requiring signages. The signs get ripped down, so that's why we're not proposing the kinds of signage in every situation.
I think it should be specific to the type of investigation we're doing and the type of work we're trying to accomplish.
Thank you. And then just to pick up on what the mayor was saying, these tapes could be used by the independent police review should there be a complaint about police behavior?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go to the sign-up sheet. So now we're taking comments on either of these two items.
We have six people left now.
Okay.
The first four are Joe Walsh, Delina Carolyn Easterly, Dan Handelman, and Becky Strauss.
Hi, welcome back, I think, for everybody.
Let's go ahead and go with Suzanne Hayden as well now.
Mr. Handelman, do you want to start?
Certainly, Your Honor. Although it's very unusual to have two items stuck together, especially when you have a report that's as thick as the one, I'm hoping I can
it's
spend
It's really two. Not unusual.
Okay. I'd like to request 2 minutes on each item, if that's all right.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. My name is Dan Handelman. I'm with Portland Cop Watch. And related to the illegal drug impact area report, I wanted to speak about the fact that the drug-free zones were mostly done away with because of our concerns, this community's concerns, and the report, the Campbell Report's concerns that they were unfairly targeting African Americans. Of the 417 exclusions that were described before, 162 of the excluded people were African American. That's 39% in a 6% black city. And only 28% of the cases involved African Americans, meaning their exclusion rate is much higher. And there's still no reporting on the enforcement of the zones, how many people get picked up for trespassing once they violate the exclusion, what kinds of people are getting trespassed. And despite race being one of the main reasons for dismantling the drug-free zones, there's no analysis of these statistics in the report that you're considering today. Is this an improvement? Under the drug-free zone program, at least 55% of the exclusions were for African Americans, so the numbers are down. The police were giving the exclusions out with no judicial oversight, so that's better. But there's still a question of why the police might be targeting certain people for arrests in the first place. Many in the community think that is racial profiling. The new numbers also show what appears to be racial bias in the criminal justice system. Also, the two people's names that were specifically listed in the report as having been turned over to federal prosecutors for drug crimes. One is an African-American man, one is a Latino man, and the DA is bragging about the federal prosecution as proof that heroin cocaine dealers are no longer able to operate in downtown and Old Town, but they both happen to be people of color that are singled out. And the public involvement, I appreciate that there's business people and residents in these areas that are involved in the discussions, but it affects the whole community, and I don't think there's been enough discussion, even in this year since we had this introduced with the whole community, about the effects. And I also, I'd like to see if there's a difference between plea bargains and actual convictions when these when the exclusions are issued. So now on to the cameras. What really needs to be addressed about the cameras is whether these cameras are in violation of ORS 181575. That's the statute that we're concerned about with the Joint Terrorism Task Force that prohibits collection or maintenance of information about people's political, social, or religious affiliations with no suspicion of criminal activity. Are they only going to be turned on when there's criminal activity present? Probably not. Are officers only going to check their phones when there's potential criminal activity? Probably not. I spoke with Deputy City Attorney Wobrow last week, and he said that the city already has cameras all over the place, which I'm surprised about. The statute is about law enforcement gathering this. We've heard about private businesses having cameras all over the place, but we're talking about giving them to law enforcement. That's where the danger is. Mr. Wobrow shrugged at my concerns about this being on the consent agenda last week when I pulled it off, saying there was nothing sinister about it. I don't think there's anything sinister, but we do need to have a discussion before this gets put through. This is the chief already described that they're planning to use this for gangs as well as for the drug impact area. So we have had no discussion about a broader use of these cameras, and I don't remember this being brought up when the IDAs were first brought into place.
May I ask you a question, and we'll extend your time?
Okay.
You said you believe there's a question under state law as to whether you can have a camera record what's going on in a street corner. Let's say that camera was being monitored by a police officer. Effectively, what would be the difference between having a police officer stationed at that corner versus having a camera monitored by a police officer in terms of the state law question you raised?
I was just getting to that, Commissioner Fish. I'm glad you asked. So Mr. Wilbur actually asked that question, too. He said, Dan, do you think that an officer should walk down the street with their hands over their eyes because they're collecting information through their eyes the whole time? And my answer to that is that it's more akin to an officer walking down the street and writing everything down that he sees in a notebook and then having to cross out the parts that have nothing to do with criminal activity afterwards. These cameras are recording the information for 24 hours. So having the cameras is very different from a human being.
But just in fairness, Dan, and I'm sure the mayor will extend your time, I don't mean to eat into it, but on that theory, you would say that an officer that has photographic memory would be subject to a different standard than